This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
It is the end of the month. As a matter of fact, we're ending out second quarter of the year as well. Typically, once a month, we do a segment called On the Record, where we get to ask Jim some questions, put Jim in the hot seat, and take away his insulative rear-end protection. And let's go with some questions here. This is quite often a collection of emails we get from listeners. Number one, you've started a premium service on the website. Why are you charging?
Well, very easy. We run three businesses. I have my own broker-dealer. I have an RIA, an investment management company, and we have Financial Sense. And each business has to be self-sustaining. So it's one of the reasons we're charging. However, we are always going to keep the weekend edition of the program that you listen to on weekends. There's never going to be a charge for that. We're going to continue to do that. But plain and simple, I'm a capitalist. And, you know, when costs go up, the site has to pay for itself. And so it needs to be self-sustaining. So that's what we did. And then I think another reason that we started to do that, John, because it is a more limited audience, there are a lot more things that we can do with the interviews. I mean, some of the interviews are longer. We're getting into issues in a more in-depth way than we did before. We're focusing more on not only just the issues, but a lot of the guests that I have on the program, I interview and say, okay, if that's what you believe, or this is where you think things are going to play out, how would you invest given this kind of environment? You know, we get into more specificity with a lot of our guests. And so it's something I'm able to do with the premium service. And we're able to do things that I want to do. There are a lot of people are saying, how come we don't cover gold every week? Well, we do. We have people that talk about gold on this program every single month, but this is not a gold show. We're not going to tell you every single week you got to go out and buy juniors because they're going to be taken over this month, or why gold is going to the moon every single week. There are other podcasts out there that you can do that and listen to. We like to cover a wider variety of topics of interest that we hope to our listeners with a wider variety of guests. Some of the lineup of guests that we got coming up in our premium service is just incredible. I just did an interview with Dr. Lawrence Kotlikoff, who was on the commission that took a look at the government's unfunded budget liabilities in the future. And the report was so bad. He was on this commission when he was in the Bush administration. And when they came out and took a look at this, they said, we don't want to redo that. They tabled it. And so he got frustrated, left the Bush administration, went back to academic world, and published a book. He's got a new book out, and we just interviewed him. And you've heard me talk about this with John Williams on the program, that the government's unfunded liabilities are over $200 trillion. According to Dr. Lawrence Kotlikoff, it's $222 trillion, up $11 trillion just in the last year as a result of the phase-in of Obamacare. So up $11 trillion in a single year. And then another interview that we'll be playing next week is with a new documentary film out there. It's called Fools on the Hill by Jerome LeBaron. And it's one man's quest to get bills passed in the legislature that requires that any piece of legislation be exposed to the public so the public has a chance to read the bill if the congressmen aren't going to read the bill or your state legislator. And he tried to get it passed in North Dakota. It didn't pass. And it's amazing when you look at this. It's closely related to what goes on in your state legislature as well as what goes on in Washington. About 98% of the bills passed, the congressmen don't read them. They get a summary of the bill given to them by the lobbyists that they turn to for their expertise, or they have some administrative aide who summarizes the bill for them, and then the senator or congressman goes and votes for it. Do you really think somebody read 2,700 pages of the health care bill or over 2,000 pages of the Dodd-Frank bill? You know, it's kind of like the Nancy Pelosi statement. Well, you got to pass it to find out what's in it. And this is alarming that we're passing this major legislation. But anyway, to answer that question, John, every business that I run has to be self-sustaining. The premium service makes the interview portion of what we do self-sustaining, and it also allows us to do some things that we couldn't do in the public format.
I remember when I was doing a daily talk radio in Denver one time during the middle of a hot dispute, one of the callers said, Jim, well, I wish I had a cushy job like you talking on the radio. I said, cushy? I said, I go 11 hours a day reading until my eyeballs fall out and everything else to make this show possible. You know, we don't just sit down here and yap.
Yeah, I mean, I go through, what, 2 reams of paper, almost 1,000 sheets of paper, just in either stuff I read, newsletters, various research reports we get, whether it's on the economy, the markets, technical service, not to mention the books I read. When you're going to interview an author like Dr. Lawrence Kotlikoff, it makes for a better interview if you read the guy's book. Otherwise, you're going to say, did you always want to be a college professor? You know, you get these dumb questions that you sort of get on the cable channels where you never get into depth. So, yeah, there's a lot of work. I used to do a 4-minute segment in television for every 1 minute on the air required 1 hour of preparation. And I know you have your own show. How many hours of preparation for that?
It probably takes 2 days to be able to review stories, check sources, and contact, maybe 2 to 3 days. It's hard to say because it happens over the course of 2, 3, 4 days, so it's hard to put together all the time. But to boil it down to a 90-minute weekly news program, it takes a lot of effort. You have to be right.
Yeah, and I know between Thursday evening, I probably spend 4 hours putting together notes, research material. When I read, I have little sticky things. So they're like little flags. And I also write on it, and I put it in a file. Staff meeting, file for research, or I write radio on it. And when I get to Thursday night, I've got a stack that's probably 4 or 5 inches thick, and I just go through it. And I've got a radio section. I put it all together, and it becomes the topics that we use here in the big picture. So there's a lot of work that goes into this.
All right, let's move on to the next question. With Taxageddon just around the corner, well, I guess it's 6 months away. But anyway, with Taxageddon around the corner, do dividends still make sense? You know, you've been talking about that because taxes are going up, especially if we're going to see a 3.8% tax additional surcharge tacked on to dividends and royalties and rents and things like that.
Absolutely. I mean, the unfortunate thing with these taxes, that 3.8%, John, is not just going to be a tax on dividends. It's going to be a tax on interest. It's going to be a tax on interest from bonds. It's going to be a tax on interest that you get at the bank. It's going to be a tax for the first time on interest. It's going to be a tax for the first time on rentals. It's going to be a tax for the first time on annuity payouts. So taxes are going up across the board. What you have to realize is if you're looking at retirement planning or saving for retirement or even investing long term, how are you going to take care of inflation? If everything you have is fixed, if your pension is fixed, if your salary is fixed, or let's say your investment income is fixed, how are you going to take care of inflation? And we'll get into this in a case study that we're going to present in this segment of the show today, when we get to lifetime income series. But you need something that is going up. It's just like if you own a rental property, you can raise the rents with inflation. And so you need something that's going to go up to take care of inflation, because one of the biggest mistakes that people make, whether they're investing, I mean, there was a study done by 3 professors out of England, I think the London School of Economics, and it was called Triumph of the Optimist. And I've often mentioned this on the program. It was a study of 16 stock markets over the last 100 years. And over 40% of the return in the stock market has come from dividends. And if you're looking at a long period of time, either 25 years spent in retirement or 30 years spent in your working career, you start compounding with dividends, your rate of return is so much higher over a longer stretch of time. And I think one thing that people forget about when they retire is the average retiree, husband and wife, between the two of them, can expect to spend 25 years in retirement. And the inflation rate that they use in planning for retirement, and this is statistically, this is what has occurred over the last, let's say, half century. At times, the rate has been higher. At times, it's been lower. But the average rate has been 4%. Now, at a 4% inflation rate, it doesn't sound like much, maybe in the first couple of years of retirement, but after 5 years of 4% inflation, it really starts to cut into your retirement. It really starts to impact you 10 years into your retirement, and from 10 to 20 years, it really starts to escalate because it's compounding. So, yes, dividends still make sense. It makes sense whether you're investing to accumulate money for retirement, and it makes sense if you're investing during your retirement, because what are you going to do for an inflation hedge? And it's one of the biggest mistakes, as you'll see when we get into this case study, when we talk about lifetime income. So, absolutely, John, dividends have made sense. Investment pros will tell you that over 40% of your return comes from dividends. And in this kind of investment environment, where on the Friday that we're speaking, you have interest rates at the lowest. Let's put it this way. 2 weeks ago, the interest rate on a 10-year treasury got down to 1.45%. That is the lowest interest rate that we have seen since Alexander Hamilton was Secretary of the Treasury. So that just goes to show you how far we've gone with financial repression. And, you know, I'm looking at a one-year treasury bill that is 0.2%. I'm looking at a two-year treasury note that's 0.3%. And we have inflation rates that are running at 3 or 4%. So absolutely, dividends make sense.
Well, you're in the inflationary camp. I don't think anyone doubts that after these many years. But, you know, nevertheless, you and Rob Bernard talk about bonds every week. This would seem to be somewhat contradictory. Why do you do that?
One of the reasons we try to talk about bonds here on the program is the statistic. I can't remember the exact figure, but I think, John, it's $1.4 trillion has gone into bond funds by the investment public since 2007, and it continues to accelerate at a very fast speed now, especially with the dips that we've seen in the economy and the stock market correction that we've seen periodically here over the last month. And there was a record amount of money that went into bond funds in the month of May. What happened in June? One of the best records for the stock market that we've had in probably a decade. One of the best Junes that we've had. But one of the reasons I'll explain this, people don't understand what can happen when interest rates change. And I'm just going to take the 10-year treasury note. Right now, on this Friday, the 10-year treasury note is at 1.645. Let's just call it 1.65. In the U.S., if interest rates went up by 0.5%, you would lose roughly about 5% if interest rates went up by 0.5%. So basically, you would lose almost 2.5 times what you're getting in interest. If interest rates went up 1 full percentage point, let's say we went back from 1.6 to 2.6. Now, remember, we were there 3 months ago. You would lose 8.6% of your principal. That would be the drop in the value. If we went up 1.5%, you'd lose almost 13%. And if we went up 2 full percentage points, in other words, we went from 1.6 to 3.6, you would lose 16.5%. And if we normalize and go up 3 percentage points, where we went back up to where normalized interest rates usually are, 4.5 to 5%, let's say where Greenspan and Bernanke were raising interest rates up until the 2007 recession, where the Fed funds rate got up to 5%, you would lose 24%. If you're in a bond fund, there is no definite maturity. That's number one. Two, if you're in a bond fund, as more money comes into the fund, the bond fund manager has to invest that money and buy bonds, and especially when interest rates are going down, he has to buy bonds that pay less interest. So what happens is, in the end, they end up cutting the dividend. So if you take a look at a very popular ETF such as TLT, the dividend on TLT has fallen every single month over the last couple months, and is down over 35% from where the dividend was last summer. So that's why we like to talk about bonds. If you do a laddered bond portfolio, number one, let's say if I have bonds that mature in 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, 10 years, I know if I have a high-quality bond, if the bond comes due in 3 years, I get 100% of my money back. I can reinvest it at a higher interest rate. More importantly, once I buy that bond, I lock in my interest rate. It doesn't go down. If I buy a bond that's paying me 4%, it's going to pay me 4% until that bond matures. So that's another reason we use it. We also use it for a lot of parents who are now looking at funding their children's education. You know, we can be very specific and know exactly, like, for example, buying a tax-free zero coupon municipal bond, we know exactly what is going to come due when your child is a freshman, sophomore, junior, senior year. So we use it not only for college planning, we also use it in retirement planning for future medical expenses, so you can more custom tailor what you're going to have. Number one, you protect your income. It doesn't get diluted. Number three, I have an inflation hedge, because if I have a laddered portfolio, I have bonds that are always coming due, and I can always reinvest them at a higher interest rate. And I would probably say a fourth reason we do this, there are people out there that are never going to go back into the stock market. I think we've lost a segment of investors in the stock market, given that we've had a bear market from 2000 to 2002, where the stock market lost 40%. We had another bear market from 2007 to 2009, where the stock market lost a little over 40%. Now, I think there's ways you can protect yourself against that. There's things that you can do, which we'll get into this lifetime income series. But John, it's one of the reasons why we talk about bonds here, because if people are going to invest in bonds, we want to make sure that they're doing it in the right way. They protect themselves, they protect dilution against income, they have an inflation hedge, and they can target specific retirement or personal investment goals, whether it's planning for retirement, funding a child's education, planning for future medical expenses. You can be more specific with what you do in the planning process.
We have long talked about the crisis window from 2009 to 2012, as well as the peak oil issue. We did a lot of discussion on that. And then before some of the later developments occurred, we were talking about a train wreck somewhere around 2014 to 2016, and there is basically another crisis window, but much more severe, consisting of several storms coming together, such as a currency issue as well as an energy issue. So first of all, since we haven't discussed it lately, do you still believe in peak oil? If not, what changed your mind?
Absolutely do I believe in peak oil. In fact, we've had the IEA, which has confirmed that conventional oil has peaked. We have the EIA, which is the government, which has confirmed that conventional oil has peaked. You have companies like ExxonMobil that are saying that, look, we're going to invest almost $185 billion over the next decade, and it's not going to be in conventional oil. It's going to be in shale. It's going to be in natural gas, tight oil, and deep water oil. So what does that tell you? So, yes, we still believe in it. I think what has happened is the crisis window has been pushed out as a result of horizontal drilling in fracking, where you have places like, for example, North Dakota is producing more oil now than, let's say, Alaska. And so this has given us what I call a temporary reprieve. And the question that I fear is we're not taking advantage of it. We're not accelerating towards an alternative energy system, whether it's renewables, whether it's high-speed rail for a transportation system or natural gas, whether it's nuclear power for electricity, if we're going to go to hybrids. So, yes, we still believe in peak oil. I think what we've had is we've been granted, through technology, a reprieve, and it's been pushed out a little further as a result of technological changes, which have come from basically two things, which has been fracking and horizontal drilling.
Yeah, plus also I would think that there's a downturn in demand. Remember, there were two facets to peak oil. One was the long-term decline of peak oil. The other was the increase of demand over daily production. And that has been ameliorated just a bit, first of all, because of the euro crisis and also because of the recession here in the United States. The demand for oil dropped down. But as soon as we see, say there were to be a recovery in the economy, then you'd immediately see the peak oil thing start kicking back in again. They're counterbalanced here.
Yeah, and that gets to my petro business cycle, that if you take a look at the Western countries, oil consumption is down in the United States. It's fallen by several million barrels a day because of less demand for it. And so as a result of we're producing more of it and there's less demand for it here in the United States, it's taken some of the pressure off global markets. If you look at the IEA reports that talk about oil demand will be up 800,000 barrels this year over last year, it's actually up by 1.2 million barrels globally as a result of growth in China, India, and the BRIC countries. But oil demand is down by 400,000 barrels when you take the Western countries like the United States, Canada, Japan, and Europe. So demand is still growing, but demand is falling in the Western countries, and that's helped ameliorate some of this demand pressure we have, assuming, John, we don't get anything like what happened last year with Libya, where we had 1.6 million barrels that was taken offline. I've even noticed with this kind of embargo against Iranian oil, the State Department keeps granting exemptions to all of Iran's major trading partners. So really, an empty threat in itself. But what has also helped offset, as you correctly pointed out, John, is there's less demand in Western countries, so that the increase in demand that we're seeing from the emerging world has put less pressure on the oil market. But once again, if Europe comes out of a recession, if economic growth begins to accelerate in the United States, what you'll see is exactly what you saw in the first quarter. You'll see an increase in the price of oil as stronger economic growth puts greater demand on energy, and you get these price spikes. And I think it has a lot to do with the shortened business cycles that we've seen in 2010, 2011, and once again in 2012.
Well, we come to the subject you've already mentioned, lifetime income. We've had a lot of really positive response to this. What brought it about? And obviously, I think we're going to make it a continuing feature here on the program.
I think there were a number of things that brought it about. One of them is the response that we get from a lot of callers that call into our firm who are caught unaware with retirement. In a weakened economy, a lot more workers are getting early retirement incentives. It's happening with company after company. It's even happening with government, where they're basically going to their older employees and saying, look, we're going to give you an incentive package if you retire early. And here's what the incentive package is. It could be a lump sum payment, maybe 1 year's worth of salary as an exit and a rollover or an annuity option. So all of a sudden, people that plan to say, hey, I'm going to work to age 62 and 65, all of a sudden at age 60, they're retiring 2 years earlier, let's say, than they planned on because of changes in the economy as a result of what companies are doing, or as a result of a weakened economy, they're getting early retirement, or they've been laid off. And the other thing that I think that is also hitting people is that we're dealing with financial repression. We're dealing with an era of almost 0% interest rates. You know, if you go back 10, 12 years ago and take a look at where interest rates were, I mean, you were making 5, 6% in money market funds. You had no problem getting 6, 7, 8% in bonds. You could get CDs at the bank that were 5 or 6%. I mean, we were getting interest rates that, you know, you can't even get in a 30-year treasury. A 30-year treasury bond pays 2.75%. So that's been a change that has caught a lot of people by surprise that they've accumulated these assets. Now it's time to live off those assets, and they're not getting the investment returns in the stock market, or they're not getting the investment returns on interest that they thought they were going to get. And then I would say, John, probably the third reason that people are so frightful and fearful is they are uninformed when it comes to about retirement. You know, should I take an annuity? If I do take an annuity from a company, what kind of annuity option? What is the taxation? What are the income tax laws? What are all the tax ramifications that come with deferred comp, IRA rollovers, 401B, 407 plans? There's just a plethora of different retirement planning options out there, not to mention the income tax consequences, the estate tax consequences, and furthermore, not to mention the complexities of longevity. And all of a sudden, people have this thrust upon them, and they don't have a plan. So that's why we spent so much time last week talking about the planning process, because when you have a plan, and you break your retirement down into different segments. Usually we recommend 5-year periods of your retirement. So if you take the average couple, we'll spend between husband and wife, let's say between the two of them, they're going to spend 25 years in retirement. You break that retirement into 5-year increments, and you have to have a budget, essential budget. You have to have a wish for budget. You have to have medical plan contingencies. Unless you go through a planning process and prepare for that, then you're almost going to get hit with the ostrich syndrome, where it's just like you get fearful, you don't do anything, and you get stage fright where you say, I don't know what to do. So the best thing I'm going to do is not do anything. And then all of a sudden, the further and further you go along, I've had people that have called us, John, that have been in cash for the last 3 or 4 years, almost 5 years since the crisis began in 2008. And now they're starting to worry because it's 5 years later. They've seen their medical costs go up, their cost of living go up, and their income has gone down. Now it's really starting to hurt. So overall, that's why we've added this series, and hopefully people will find it helpful and they can start taking actions. We're going to do a lot of things when it comes to estate planning, corporate trustee, planning for long-term care, what are the appropriate retirement plan options, the right type of annuities, how to create your own defined benefit pension plan that guarantees you'll never outlive your income, all those kind of things that people are having to face. And let's put it this way. If we didn't have all these uncertainties, if we didn't have the crises that we had over the last 10 years, if we didn't have the uncertainty over health care, if we didn't have zero interest rates, we probably wouldn't be talking about these things.
You're listening to the Financial Sense NewsHour at financialsense.com. We will now start to take your calls on the Q lines, meaning question or comment line, which is open 24 hours a day to record your comment or question for the program. Please try to keep them at or below a minute so everybody gets their calls in. Toll-free number, U.S. and Canada, 800-794-6480. 800-794-6480. That number is supposed to work from the entire world. It even works from Antarctica, but somebody said it didn't work from France a couple of weeks ago. So not everything's under our control, but if you're outside the U.S. and Canada, you do have to pay for your own international rates, whatever they happen to be. 800-794-6480 in the U.S. And as we take the calls here, please remember the Financial Sense News Hour is provided to you for information and educational purposes and should not be considered what you hear here as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell securities. And our responses to your calls are based on the personal opinions of Jim Poplava. We don't know a lot about you. These are rather simple questions, and we provide simple answers. We can't take into account your suitability, your objectives, or your risk tolerance. And because of that, Financial Sense News Hour is not liable to any person for financial losses which may result from investing in companies profiled on the Financial Sense News Hour.
Hi, Jim and John. This is Bob from Sunrise. Love your show. Learn something every week. Got a question for you concerning transfer it to my mother and my wife each year as a tax-free gift. However, if one of them should pass, then obviously it would transfer back to me. What would the capital gains on that be if I was ever to sell it down the line? Would it be as of the date I took back the receipt of it, or as of the date it was purchased? Where does that come in? And when is it tax-free, when is it not, etc.? And I obviously wouldn't have to pay inheritance taxes because that's $1 million, but I'm kind of curious of where it goes for the IRS thing. Of where I'd have to pay the capital gain. Like to hear your guidance on this. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Bob, there were so many missing things here. Can you do me a favor? Email me the details on that so I can ask it. I think what you're talking about here is something about transferring assets. I'm not sure, is it your mother to your wife or from you? You need to get a little bit more specific here because right now, there's various rules that are in place. You can give so much assets away without any estate taxes and gift taxes. There's an annual allowance, and it depends on whether it's from a single person or a husband and wife. There's also the estate tax exemption this year, which is $5 million. So you could take advantage of that. So, I mean, there's so many issues here. You need to be a little bit more specific here for me to really properly answer this question.
This is Dan in Missouri. Bloomberg reports Barclays fined $451.4 million by UK and US for falsifying LIBOR rates. My question is, do those that have also traded in the same securities have any legal recourse for recovery of losses from this market manipulation? If you are thinking of buying one of those electric cars, then think again. The property taxes on an electric car may eat your wallet. And regardless of the bottom line is, don't allow that to happen. You might save money on not buying fuel, but you will end up with less paying those higher taxes year after year. Best to stick with something inexpensive for the average family and pay less taxes. You'll be more likely to have investment cash and be able to pay for your next car with the savings. Comments, Jim?
Okay, Dan. Barclays was fined for falsifying LIBOR rates. And what you're basically saying, if you participated in those trades and were disadvantaged as a result of the manipulation in the way those trades were reported, you could probably file a lawsuit. Good luck. You could become part of a class action lawsuit. It's my experience in those kind of suits. The lawyers take just about everything. So I'm not sure that would be a very promising course of action to take, Dan. In terms of electric car, I still like the concept, especially if you design your life around what I call live, work, and play, where you live very close to where you work, very close to where you have to do your main shopping. And so basically, you can drive around on an electric battery. It sure beats paying for gas at the pump, especially here in California, where it's over $4 a gallon.
Yes, this is Jeremy from Graham, North Carolina, and just love the show, been listening for years. My question for Mr. Poplava is, you've mentioned financial repression being a policy of the U.S. government back in the 1960s. Do you know how long that took, and was it a 100% solution for the government's debt? And if so, if we're under financial repression today, has anyone done the math on how long it would take the government to pay off all of its debt? Are we talking decades or several decades or centuries here? Thanks.
Jeremy, we began the program in 1951. Actually, the Fed began a program called Operation Twist back in 1951, and it worked for about two decades. And then when we got to the end of the 60s, and especially when we implemented Lyndon Johnson's Great Society programs, which increased entitlements, and then also we got involved in Vietnam. It was basically guns and butter, pretty much kind of what happened in the last decade, where President Bush increased the drug prescription benefit and then attacked Iraq with the second Iraq war. And so basically we increased entitlements at the same time we increased military expenditures. So at the latter part of the 60s, since the dollar was backed by gold, there was a run on our gold reserves, and Nixon took us off the gold window. And once he did that, we began to depreciate our currency. The Fed began to print more money, and inflation took off, and it began to backfire because eventually, by the end of the decade, we had interest rates that were double digit. And of course, Paul Volcker, when he took over from the Fed, raised interest rates to stop inflation and took us all the way up to 18% interest rates on, I'm trying to think of the federal funds rate. It was high double digits. I know long-term treasuries got to about 15.5%. We would never get that far today. The whole thing would collapse. We did get our debt to GDP ratios down to a more sustainable level by the end of the 60s. The unfortunate thing is we increased those entitlements with the Great Society program and the Vietnam War. And then there was no end to budget deficits once we no longer backed the dollar by gold. And from that point forward, we never balanced our books again.
Hey, guys. Mike Tucson here. First of all, great work on the changes you've made to the show. I think it's really amazing and gotten even better somehow. I had a few requests. I thought Alan Newman was a great guest, and I hope you'll keep having him on. Another voice I haven't heard from in a while is Victor Sparandio. He's reading his book, Legends of the Wall Street Master, and I'd really like to get his take. Maybe you guys could have him on as a technical analyst. Finally, just read an article in the Wall Street Journal about domestic oil production. The article stated that U.S. production had grown 6% since October 2011. I find that pretty astounding. Hope that you guys will cover the peak oil story or continue to cover it. in greater detail, maybe in the bigger picture or with Eric Townsend's segment. Thanks, guys. Keep up the great work.
Mike, we're going to cover some of that today with what you're referring to, the Wall Street Journal article. I saw that a lot of that is the Bakken shale play, where oil production has gone from, I think, 50,000 barrels to almost 500,000 barrels. We're producing more oil in the Bakken than we are in Alaska. A lot of these shale plays have contributed to the increase in U.S. oil production, and that's where it's coming from.
Yeah, hi, Jim. This is Richard calling from California. Jim, the Supreme Court decision on Obamacare reaffirms the tax increases. The decision would seem to put a stick in the spokes of Congress to undo Tax-mageddon. It would seem Tax-mageddon is now assured. What is your feeling on that? Thanks for a good program. Take care.
You know, Richard, there are still lawsuits out there. It's still going to be challenged, and a lot of it can be changed come November. Governor Romney is already saying the first thing he'll do day one is repeal Obamacare. It's such a mismatch of programs, so there's still going to be more court challenges. I guess with the reaffirmation of the constitutionality of the bill by the Supreme Court this week, assuming that in the case where Obama is, let's say, reelected in November, then that would go into effect January 1st, because he's not walking away from that. So the only way that this could change is really if the presidency changes in November. Otherwise, if the president is reelected, then you're right. It is a stake. It's reaffirmed, and those taxes will go into effect January 1st.
You're listening to the Financial Sense NewsHour at financialsense.com. And now that well-anticipated series, Lifetime Income, which we're doing here on the program. Last week, we talked about planning for retirement. We had six steps that you should follow. Let me review them. We were hoping at the time to take some of the out of planning. When you look at it, it can be sort of a daunting event. But number one, gather all your financial information, your income, your expenses. Basically, you're putting together a projected budget. Number two, determine what your income needs are. First of all, you divide this into two categories. Your basic income needs. What do you need to subsist, so to speak? Your income and your expenses. And then the second half of that is income and expenses based on a bucket list, meaning the things you would like to do. Number three, once you determine those things, put together a portfolio that handles each scenario, each of those two previous scenarios. And number four, estimate inflation and investment returns that you're going to be seeing in the future. This is part of your planning. Number five, implement your plan. And as you're doing that, over time, you have to monitor the progress of your plan because the world keeps changing. You monitor it for changes in healthcare needs, tax law, the economy, as well as currency. Markets. Those are the things you do. So that's the six-step plan that we covered last week. So this week, what we would like to do is look at some of the risks that are entailed. One that, it's almost a negative return risk on a positive situation. You know, early on, you can plan for, say, for example, inflation or changes in taxation, something like that. There's a risk called longevity risk. Because if you're not planning on keeling over tomorrow or the day after that or quite a few years from now, you have to plan for that.
Yeah, people think of longevity risk. It's a good thing in the fact that people are living longer throughout their retirement years, but it also creates another risk that most people aren't planning when they're, let's say, during their working career. And the longevity risk entails three additional risks. Number one, you outlive your assets. You die broke. Two, healthcare cost. And as we covered in another segment, healthcare costs rise throughout retirement. It's probably your fastest growing expense, whether it's supplemental Medicare insurance. And as we just covered in a previous segment, if you do have very expensive medical expenses, it's going to be harder to deduct them on your taxes because they're raising the bar on which you have to exceed to get those deductions because of the change in Obamacare. And then the other thing that happens often is inadequate income for a surviving spouse. For example, husband and wife both receive in Social Security. Husband passes away. The wife has the option of taking her Social Security or her husband's, whichever is larger. But you lose one source of income. And there are many cases where there are pension plans, either from the government or from a company, where the pension plan continues for the surviving spouse, but the pension is reduced. So you have inadequate income. So the longevity risk are three things that you have to plan for that you weren't thinking about during your working career. And so that's why it encompasses a whole different way of planning. And John, concomitant with these different risks is there are other things that you have to develop, which is a change in the way that you view your income, your portfolio. You should have a high level of confidence that the income you need for essential living expenses is going to be there for the rest of your life. So if your basic budget is $3,000 a month, $4,000 a month, five, whatever that number is, you have to have a high level of confidence that that income is going to come and arrive every single month. You don't want to be betting, well, I've got it now for a couple of years, but I'm not sure about it in the future years. That's not a good plan. Another thing you need to take a look at, and this is totally different from the way most people plan for their retirement, is the assets you need for income today need to be invested differently than those that you're going to use into the future. And the financial risk that you face in retirement impact you differently over time. So your income strategy should reflect this. And when I say what is going to impact you differently over time, if you take a 4% inflation rate for general living expenses or a 5% for medical expenses, you know, your first couple of years of retirement, you're not going to notice that. But let me guarantee you, by the end of year five, you're going to begin to notice that 4% and 5% inflation rate, because it's going to start to dig in and you're going to feel that difference in real terms, in terms of purchasing power. So that's why this involves a planning process and it needs to be specific. You can't talk in generalities when it comes to retirement. Gosh, I'd like to retire at this age. What if that doesn't happen? What if you get laid off? What if the company gives you an early retirement option? And you need to be more specific and say, well, gosh, I'd like to stay where I'm at, but I'd like to go to Europe, travel. I'd like to take up some extra hobbies. And that's why you need to be specific. And the more specific you are, the better plan you're going to handle those unexpected contingencies that have a habit of cropping up.
And that's why we emphasize dividing your budget into what you need versus what you want. So let's get down to an actual case study. The names involved here have been changed to protect identity, but it is a real world case. So go ahead.
Yeah, obviously, we've changed the names and some of the circumstances, but you're going to find this case involves so many of the things that people face when they head into retirement. We're going to call this Bill and Jan Smith. Is the name of the couple. Bill is age 66. He's currently retired. His wife, Jan, is age 58. She will retire in 2 years at roughly about 66% of her salary will be paid in what is called a defined benefit pension plan, meaning she knows exactly what she's going to get in 2 years. She's actually a teacher. And in California, you get 2.2% of your salary for each year that you worked. So in two more years, Jan will have 30 years as a teacher. You take 30 years times 2.2%. She will get 66% of her salary when she retires. Now, let me give you a little background here because you're going to be able to relate to a lot of this. You may find yourself in similar circumstances. Bill's background, he was a high-tech executive. He got laid off he prefers to call it a preferential early retirement package in 2006. At the time he was given that preferential retirement package, he had two choices. He could have taken his pension. In other words, he could have taken an annuity option, which would have given him $6,000 a month as long as he lived, and that pension would have been reduced by a third for his wife. He chose not to do that. Instead, he rolled over his pension plan into an IRA rollover. We'll get more into that next week when we talk about solutions. Jan is a grade school teacher. She is, once again, age 58. She's got two more years in retirement, and she will have 30 years as a teacher. And the formula here in San Diego, in her school district, is 2.2% times each year that she worked. So she will be age 60. She will have 30 years as a teacher, and she will get roughly 66% of her current salary, is about $80,000. And we estimate at the time that she retires with pay increases that that salary will be roughly about $82,000, of which she'll get 66%.
You know, this reflects a real-life circumstance, because here we see that Bill is retired and his wife's still working, but he was going to be laid off, or you know, a lot of people are moved in or forced into retirement sooner than they anticipated. So suddenly, bang, there they are.
Yeah, and that's exactly. He wasn't planning on retiring at age 60. He was planning on continuing to work, but they gave him an early retirement package. He had no choice, either taking a lump sum or take it in an annuity package. And remember, back in 2006, the stock market was still going up. The economy was still growing. We hadn't hit the crisis that we hit in the latter part of 2007, in 2008. So he chose a lump sum. And remember, his wife was still working and had a good job. But Bill's Social Security is roughly about $1,450 a month. Let's just round it off and call it $1,500. That averages roughly about $17,400 a year. Jan's salary right now is currently $80,000 a year. When she retires, we estimate her final income will be roughly about $82,000. Take 66% of that. Her pension will be roughly $54,000 a year. Now, so if we take Bill's Social Security, Jan does not get Social Security because she gets her pension from STRS, the State Teachers Retirement System. So she gets $54,000. Bill's Social Security is $17,000. So their combined retirement income, this is income that comes every single month, will be roughly about $72,000 when Jan retires in 2 years. You know, Bill's Social Security will go up a little bit, so let's round that off to $72,000. Now, the problem is that their budget, currently, they're spending about $108,000 a year. Now, they get almost $100,000 from Jan's salary and Bill's Social Security. Their budget is $108,000, and the difference between what they take in an income of $99,000 and let's say $108,000 is made up with withdrawals that Bill takes from his IRA. However, we've got a problem. And that problem is their budget. Let's just keep this simple. Their budget is $110,000. When Jan retires in 2 years, their income is going to be $72,000 a year. You take that against a budget of $110,000, there is a $38,000 a year, a little over $3,000 a month shortfall between what they're spending now, given the income they have coming in now, and what they will be spending, let's say, a couple of years from now when Jan retires, when she's only going to get 66% of her current salary versus the salary she's making now.
Well, if we're following your plan, I would suspect that the first thing you probably had them do was to do that budget you're talking about and dividing things into needs versus wants.
Absolutely. And that's what I did. I took their $110,000 a year budget. I had them put together two budgets that they did for me. And they took a look at, and we had their budget in what we call essential column. And we had what we call a wish list or will it vary column, because We know that certain things like healthcare premiums and other various expenses, property taxes, insurance costs, car insurance, food costs, those things are going to change. And so what I did is I said, look, you need to put together a budget of essential cost. You know, take the things that aren't going to be there. And I helped them with this process. The one thing that Jan is not going to do, Jan currently contributes roughly about almost $6,500 out of her $80,000 into the state teacher retirement system. So when Jan retires and she gets that $54,000, the one thing she's not going to be paying is roughly $6,500 into the state teacher retirement system. That goes away. The second thing that we subtracted from the budget was the vacations. They're spending a little over $10,000 a year on vacations. I said, look, we'll put that in the wish for column, but we really need to get it down to a bare bones budget. What is it going to cost you to live? Now, for some people that live elsewhere in the country, in California, believe me, living on $90,000 a year, because what we did is we removed $10,000 for vacation, the $6,500 that she paid into the state teacher retirement system, and that roughly knocked the budget down by $18,000. So what was a $108,000 budget got down to $90,000. And, I mean, you take a look at $2,000 a year for gasoline, $1,300 for insurance, maintenance on the home, commuting expenses. They had is $2,000, and that is a car replacement reserve. What they were doing is they put so much money aside into a little savings account each year, and then like every 5 years, they get a car. You have the vacation, which we removed. They spend roughly about $2,400 a year dining out. That's roughly about $200 a month. $150 a month in entertainment is everything from sporting events, baseball games, to movies. There's an umbrella policy they have in the house. They have income taxes, which we had to budget. Now that'll come down. They have homeowner insurance. They do have a small mortgage on the house. They have property taxes, roughly $4,300. They have utility bills, cable bills, electric bill $2,000, telephone, cable, internet fees, water and sewer is $4,000. Now, this may sound expensive for many of you that live in the Midwest, but just understand that California utility rates are probably 50% above the national average. So when you hear some of these expenses, dental, vision, hearing, $2,300. Medicare supplemental insurance, roughly $5,100 for bill. Out-of-pocket prescription drug cost, $1,000. They do have a long-term care policy. I'll get into that in a second, at $2,300. So, you know, when you hear a $90,000 budget, essential budget, you think, wow, these guys are living in Beverly Hills. No, that's middle class in California. If you're making $100,000, that's middle class here. You take the California tax rate of 9.3%, that you hit that tax rate on $50,000 of income. You take housing here, which is more expensive, food's more expensive, gas is more expensive, utilities are more expensive, insurance premiums are more, everything is more expensive in California. So I just want to point out, this isn't a spendthrift couple that are living off the hog. So what we did is we broke this down into two budgets. The essential budget was $90,000 a year. The bucket list budget was $100,000 to $105,000. The bucket list, we added back the $10,000 for travel, so that went from $90,000 to $100,000. And then also we added an extra $5,000 for extra things for their kids. They wanted to make gifts to their grandchildren to help plan for a college education. So we had, if we can break it down, the essential budget was $90,000. The wish for budget was $100,000 to $105,000. $100,000 would include the vacations. $5,000 would include the extra gifts that they wanted to make to their grandchildren.
You know, I've noticed here that Bill is older than Jan by about 8 years, I think. And, well, in addition to the fact that women typically, on an actuarial basis, outlive men, that's because we're more courageous and we take more risks, you know?
Jump off cliffs.
Yeah, right.
Drive car too fast.
The issue of longevity here does become a factor.
Yeah, and what we did is we ran a healthcare assessment, and this is questions that were turned into an actuarial firm. For example, when it comes to health, Bill has high blood pressure, high cholesterol. He has cardiovascular disease. He's taking medication for that. He is a former smoker. And the good thing is he's changed his diet and he is exercising, but he also has a family history of diabetes and cardiovascular disease. He has it himself. It's been in his family. Jan, on the other hand, is more likely to outlive Bill because, number one, because of the age difference, two, female, and then also health history. She has no blood pressure, cholesterol problems, diabetes in the family. In fact, in Jan's family, they live into the late 80s, so there's quite a bit of difference. So we filled out a medical questionnaire, and we submitted that to the health risk company, and they came up with medical expenses because Bill right now is spending roughly about $2,600 for supplemental Medicare insurance, and he's also spending $2,300 a year for long-term care premiums. His life expectancy, given his current health condition, he would be expected to live to age 81, where Jan would be expected to live well beyond that. She could expect to live to almost age 90, given the genetics in her family and given her health history of good health. And so if we take a look at this over a period of time, and what the health risk did is they ran this in five-year increments, and that's what you really have to do. You have to think of five-year increments, and it would roughly run with not only what Jan is paying for insurance. Remember, as a teacher, she would get private health care insurance when she retires at age 60 until age 65, and at age 65, she would be put in the Medicare system. But in between 2014, 2018, the healthcare costs would run about $11,000. Between 2019 and 2023, they'd be roughly about $15,000. Between 2024, 2028, they'd be about $17,000. 2029, 2033, they'd be roughly about $23,000. They would drop between 2034. That has to do with that Bill would probably pass on given his life expectancy. So we had to run one of those, John, because what we had to do is we had to take a look at what are the healthcare risks. Bill is already paying that for supplemental Medicare, and he also has a long-term care insurance policy in case he ended up going into a retirement home.
So we put the essential budget together. It's based on about $90,000. We have a bucket list of 10 to 15. And now we need to look at their both of their pension incomes and see if there's a surplus or shortfall.
If we take a look at, okay, so we have a $90,000 essential budget. We have a bucket list budget of $10,000 to $15,000. So, you know, if we combine both of them together, it's a wish list of $105,000 a year. The most important thing that we had to focus on is the essential budget is $90,000 a year. Now, what they're going to have in guaranteed income is Bill's Social Security, which is roughly about $17,400 now. That's roughly $1,450 a month. That should be roughly about $18,000 by the time Jan retires. Jan's pension from the state will be $54,000. So their combined guaranteed income is going to be roughly $71,500. So we have an let's call rounded off $19,000 budget shortfall. And that's just on their basic budget. Add to that another $10,000 to $15,000. We now have almost a $30,000 to $35,000 shortfall between what they're living, the way they're living now, and the way they would like to live when Jan retires completely in 2 years from now. So here's what we have to face. One, in the budget, we have a longevity budget. We're going to have to deal with issues. We're going to have to deal with medical expenses, which are going to go up roughly about 5% a year. Two, we're going to have to deal with inflation. Three, we're going to have to deal with surviving spouse income. So what we need to do is we need to look at three sources of income. One is essential income that pays for the day-to-day living expenses. This is none of the extras. This is just saying, okay, this pays the mortgage. This pays the property taxes. This is food. This is eating out. This is not taking a vacation. of $10,000 a year is not giving $5,000 to the grandkids for their college education. That's $90,000. And on that alone, we have a shortfall of roughly $19,000. Next, we have to break it down into a portfolio. So we need to come up with a portfolio that is going to guarantee that income that Bill and Jan will never outlive, and especially for Jan, given the fact that there's an age difference here, a health difference, and also genetically longevity in Jan's side of the family. So we have to provide for essential income. Secondly, we have the bucket list, the annual vacations, the gifts to the grandchildren. And number three, we're going to have to provide for longevity income. What is going to take care of inflation? Because I can tell you that at $90,000 a year, depending on whatever inflation rate that we run into, your living expenses are going to go up each year. And I mean, there are various ways you can handle that. You can move to an area of the country where expenses are less. Obviously, living in California, utilities, housing, taxes, everything's more expensive here. So that's an option.
This is almost like a melodrama, because next week we will tell you how we solved this issue.
We're actually going to a reality podcast.
As we continue the series, Lifetime Income. You know, the day that the Supreme Court decision came down, the first instinct was to say, well, okay, that settles it all. We're on. We're just going to deal with it. We have to deal with what the taxes are going to be. I'm not so sure that's true anymore. I think this has opened up a hornet's nest, which has facets and twists and turns that really haven't been covered or anticipated by a lot of the media yet. And we'll be able to do that here on the program. But I think this is now going to become, not only it's an election issue, but in addition to that, I think you're going to see things coming out of the woodworks that nobody anticipated.
You know, I couldn't agree more. I mean, we began the month of June. This is the end of the second quarter, the end of the first half of the year. And we had these three major issues, John. We had the Greek elections, we had the Fed meeting, and of course, we had the Supreme Court decision. And these were major issues. And it's surprising, the market had one of its best months in almost a decade. So we still have more issues up in front of us, and I think you're right. I don't think this issue is going away. I think more stuff is going to be coming out. But as we get closer to the end of summer, the next big issues on the horizon are still going to be the economy, which were covered today when we talked about the LEIs decelerating, the PMIs are decelerating, the unemployment rate's going up, Europe's in a recession, China's economy slowing down, and then we have all these fiscal cliff issues that are going to confront us as we get to the end of summer. We've got the government's budget for the 2013 fiscal year. We have the debt ceiling debate. The debt ceiling is going to have to be extended. And then, of course, all of these tax issues that are going to hit the economy, plus the spending cuts January 1st. So let's put it this way. There's never going to be a dull moment, at least not this year. So on behalf of John Leffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.